The American POTUS Podcast is a 501c3 nonprofit show supported by listener patriots like you. To help us keep the program going, please join others around the nation by considering a tax-deductible donation. You can make your contribution and see what exciting plans we have for new podcasts and other outreach programs at AmericanPOTUS.org. Thank you for your support, and we hope you enjoy this episode. Coming up on American POTUS, Thomas Jefferson. This overachiever accomplished some pretty major things in his life. He wrote the Declaration of Independence, Secretary of State, Governor, Vice President, and President. But even when your career maxes out, guys like Jefferson don't just go home and retire quietly. To keep himself occupied, he turned his energy toward creating a university, an institute of higher learning that would, in his mind, ensure that generations of citizens would be diligent, keeping our new nation strong and honorable. The founding father who founded a university, Thomas Jefferson. He's next on American POTUS. I'm Scott Brun. With the help of presidential scholar Alan Lowe, we're opening the book on the men who have held our nation's highest office. By sharing their challenges, their stories, and their personalities, we hope to add some clarity and perspective for today's heated political conversations. To help us understand President Thomas Jefferson a little better is Vice President of Monticello, Andrew O'Shaughnessy. He's the Saunders Director of the Robert H. Smith International Center for Jefferson Studies and a professor of history at the University of Virginia. He's written several terrific books about our nation's revolutionary period, including the one we want to get into today, called The Illimitable Freedom of the Human Mind, Thomas Jefferson's Idea of a University. We'll have more information on this title, as well as all of his others, on our website, AmericanPOTUS.org. Andrew, we're thrilled to have you here on the show. Welcome to American POTUS.
I'm thrilled to be here.
Well, thank you, Andrew. It's been too long since we spoke, and I really appreciate you doing this. You know, I've been to Monticello so many times, and the University of Virginia, and just they exude history. So I was excited to talk with you more today about Thomas Jefferson and the university. When and why did Jefferson first conceive the idea of a University of Virginia?
Well, my book argues that he first began to think about it during the American Revolution. However, his original idea was simply to reform William and Mary College to make it one of the premier colleges in the United States. And he brought forward a bill for that in the legislature in 1779. But by the 1790s, he began to despair with the failure of his bill of ever reforming William and Mary to be of the excellence that he wanted. And in 1800, he wrote a letter to Joseph Priestley saying that he wanted to create a new University of Virginia. And I might say the headline of this book is that I can't think of any other head of state in history who spent so long discussing and thinking about every detail of the creation of a university.
It says so much about him. And of course, that remained an idea for him. Why did it attain such an urgency for Jefferson in his retirement?
It was partly because Virginia was beginning to lose ground against other states like New York and Massachusetts. It was not the great economic powerhouse that it had been in the 18th century. People were migrating, including members of his own family, west. And so he saw it as a way to regenerate Virginia. But I think much more importantly, he was concerned about the future of the Republic and whether this great experiment would survive. And he was worried that much of the education system in the country was in the hands of people he regarded as opponents. Surprisingly, even colleges in the South were dominated by the Federalists. And the other group who played an enormous role in creating both schools and colleges were the Presbyterians. But his concern was that he felt that they were indoctrinating students, and he was even more concerned because he felt that they were not passing on the real credo of the American Revolution, the principles of 1776. Some people have tried to tie it to the Missouri crisis of 1819 and 1820, which famously was about the question of slavery in states in the West and whether they would be free states or slave states. The problem with that argument is that the university was largely built by the time that the abolitionists were really beginning to gain real ground.
So even though we know it was a very good idea, he had to deal with opposition in his home state to the creation of the university. How did he deal with that opposition?
Well, the book really reveals his remarkable political skills and even deviousness with which he dealt with opponents. There was a lot of opposition to the university. It was partly religious because it was going to be a secular university. It was partly a matter of cost. It was also due to competing locations like Stanton and Richmond, as well as William and Mary College. He used a man who'd been a great friend of his since early in his presidency called Joseph Cabell, who was a member of the state Senate. He used him as his front man, much as he used Madison as the front man in Congress during the 1790s. And Cabell was remarkable in trying to orchestrate support for him in the legislature. He used propaganda. He would even write anonymous articles to the newspapers. He would distribute copies of the plans of the university, both graphic plans and architectural plans, as well as descriptions of the intended structure. He persuaded friends to stand for the legislature and helped to orchestrate support for them and persuaded others to remain in the legislature who wanted to retire. And he also, quite naughtily, gave piecemeal budgets so that rather than giving the legislature the full budget from the beginning, he did it bit by bit. And the most costly part of the university, the building of the rotunda, which is really the crown jewel of the architecture, he did not start presenting them with a bill until very late on.
Very savvy politician in many ways. So with his love of education that we see with the university, why didn't Jefferson support a state-controlled system of public education?
Well, this is really a myth. A lot of critics, and of course there are a lot these days, who tend to emphasize more the negative than the positive, have argued that he sacrificed a public school system for this elite project of creating the university. The fact is that he always insisted, consistently until his death, that having a public school system was more important than having a university. He thought it essential to have a population who could hold their government accountable and were educated enough to be able to understand politics and to be aware that most republics in history have failed and that those in power will often abuse power. And he put forward bills for a public school system in 1779, and also towards his death in 1816 and 1821. And these would have given at least 3 years of education to boys and girls. The best of the boys would then, with scholarships, go on to academies. And the very best of those, similarly with scholarships, would go to the University of Virginia. Now, it has to be said that those who would make it through the process would be a tiny proportion of the total population. But he did at least recognize the idea of merit and that people had talent regardless of their class. He also stressed to a Quaker abolitionist by the name of Pleasance in 1794 that none of his bills, and this was true of the later ones, despite what some historians have said, that they did not exclude African Americans. That is, of course, free, emancipated African Americans. There was no talk, of course, of educating the slave population.
Now, we've spoken before in American POTUS about the correspondence between Jefferson and John Adams in their later years. How did that correspondence illuminate their sometimes differing ideas about the importance of education in a republic?
Well, I use the correspondence extensively. I think it's one of the great correspondences between two elder statesmen that I'm aware of in any country, and is remarkable the way it firstly spans across so many different disciplines and interests, also the intimacy of it and what it reveals about their reflections on life, on death, on grief, and so on. But specifically, in answer to your question, Jefferson invited Adams to comment on his plans for a university and asked him for ideas and also for suggestions for books. And Adams did give him some advice on the books, but I was surprised by how little interest he took in what was clearly the great passion of Jefferson in old age, what he called his hobby of old age. And my suggestion in the book was that Adams was simply much more pessimistic about the future direction of the country and didn't see education as being the panacea. Now, I did talk to Richard Bernstein on air when I interviewed him about his excellent short biography of John Adams. Bernstein suggested it might simply have been Adams was so much older, you know, just didn't have the same level of energy. The only problem I see in that argument is that Adams's responses to Jefferson in other ways show no decrease in his mental aptitude.
And we were very fortunate to have Dr. Bernstein on with us as well on American POTUS.
It's really an excellent short book. I highly recommend it.
I certainly agree with that. And you mentioned Adams recommending books to Jefferson. We know Jefferson loved books, and I certainly share that with him. What subjects did Jefferson focus on ultimately when establishing the library for the new university?
Well, Jefferson sold most of his books to the Library of Congress, partly to relieve his debt. And after 1816, he had to build up a new library and purchase new books. So we have a very good idea about what was specifically on his mind, what he was reading. One of the most important sets of books for him was to get a set of books on Palladian architecture and for some of the major architectural books. It was a limitation for him in the early design of the university that he didn't have these books at hand, and he even had to borrow them from James Madison. And obviously architecture, as we'll discuss later, was very key to his thinking about the university. He's also very interested in the rules governing universities, especially student discipline. For example, he obtains from Thomas Cooper, the president of the South Carolina College, he obtains the set of rules that Cooper wrote. And Cooper was a great legal expert and also operating in the South. He's reading too about popular education and the British reformer Joseph Lancaster's ideas about educating children, what is known as the Lancaster system.
So he was so involved in every detail of this university. What did he include and exclude from the curriculum, and how did he go about hiring faculty? What were the principles he applied in hiring of faculty members?
He tried to make the curriculum as inclusive as possible, and I think this is a major reason why he called it a university rather than simply a college. The idea was that it was comprehensive, so that he offered law, he offered the sciences. It was one of the first places in the country to teach economics. It taught the classics, but without the normal stress on everybody having a classical education. And what was most unusual is he gave students the opportunity to choose what courses they studied and in what order, rather than following the prescribed set of courses. And that was why there were no classes at the University of Virginia, because people did not go through the university as a class. He excluded the formal teaching of theology. He was really determined, and this was at the level of public schools as well, and a major reason why none of his public school plans was ever accepted. He tried to exclude clergy from teaching unless they were Unitarians. He wanted religion taught as history, or in the context of the classics, or as philosophy in other classes. But there was no chapel at the university, and it was the only university at the time, although Transylvania and the University of North Carolina had experimented with this, but they gave up. It was the only university not to be requiring students, not simply to go to chapel on Sunday, but to go twice a day.
Now, I know those views he had on religion caused some difficulties during the creation of the university. What were those difficulties, and how did he surmount those?
Well, a major problem was recruiting students. I mean, it became known as a place of that was atheistic, where student morals could be corrupted. It also caused a huge problem in terms of funding and really nearly destroyed the entire project because of the opposition in the state. The key opposition came from the Presbyterian-dominated areas of Western Virginia, places like modern Stanton and the Shenandoah Valley. They were bitterly opposed to this plan, not least because they actually wanted the university located in Stanton or at what is now Washington and Lee University. Jefferson, I think, one of the major reasons that he wanted it in Charlottesville was that Charlottesville did not have a dominant religion, and the four religions that existed essentially shared premises right up almost until Jefferson's death.
You know, thinking about the creation of the University of Virginia, an amazing pedigree, not only Jefferson, but you also had Presidents Madison and Monroe playing a role in the creation and the administration. Can you talk with us a bit about their roles in the university?
Yes. The laying of the foundation stone in 1817 was attended by both James Madison and James Monroe. It's a marvelous example of propaganda at work, because obviously it caught the attention of people at the time. Madison was the recent outgoing president, and Monroe was actually president of the United States when these three presidents together laid the foundation stone. Madison was the most helpful of his fellow presidents. And Madison attended nearly all of the meetings of the Board of Visitors. He gave Jefferson advice and looked over Jefferson's draft and his thinking for what's known as the Rockfish Gap Commission. Madison succeeded him as rector of the university after Jefferson's death. Madison sometimes held board meetings at Montpelier. He met with professors. To my great surprise, the faculty actually spoke more highly of Madison than Jefferson. And it might just be that Madison was that bit younger and, of course, less obsessed with the project. But Madison said that he always let Jefferson have his own way because he felt it was his university and that it would rise or fall. His reputation would be adversely affected if it failed, his being Jefferson. Monroe was somewhat less involved, and that's largely because he was president for much of Jefferson's lifetime. But he did remain on the Board of Visitors for the rest of his life, and he was supportive.
Anyone who's visited the University of Virginia, and certainly who's visited Monticello, knows of Jefferson's love of and knowledge of architecture. So how did he put that knowledge to use in the design of the university?
Well, the architecture was terribly important to him. He did have some professional assistance from the very architects who were designing Washington, D.C., Benjamin Latrobe and William Thornton. But the basic plan and most of the designs were ultimately his own. He wanted it designed in a classical Palladian style, and he wanted each building to be distinctive and to actually offer students essentially instruction in the five different classical forms like Ionic and Doric and Corinthian. He also wanted the university to be what he called a village, an academical village. He didn't want it to be too centralized, and he didn't want it to be like nearly every other university at the time, one large building. This was partly for health reasons, but also because he wanted the faculty to intermingle with the students, to be with them, even at dinner and living in houses among the student houses, and to have a paternal role, much as his own professors had had at the College of William and Mary. He was, to some extent, creating the intellectual experience that he'd had as a young man. He went to college at 16, and you did ask me earlier, you know, what was his criteria for choosing the professors, and the answer to that is excellence. He wanted the very best, but it was very important to him that they not be just narrow academics and what Cardinal Newman once called one idea men. He wanted them to be people of real intellectual breadth and general interests, and he also thought it very important that they have a good teaching style and that they could communicate with young people. He seems very early on to have thought about recruiting most of his faculty in Britain rather than America. He did try to hire a few people in the United States. He tried to hire Harvard's faculty, the best of them, away from Harvard. He didn't succeed, and he said, I'm not prepared to have this sort of crumbs from Harvard, Princeton, and Yale. I want the very best. And so only one of the eight professors who formed the faculty when he first began the university, only one of them had been born in the United States. And that was very important to Jefferson, that the law professor and professor of politics be American. And the person who was teaching politics, although he'd been born in Bermuda, but he'd really spent much of his life in America and had actually been a member of Congress. And Jefferson looked at the very highest level when he was appointing a law professor. He wanted to appoint the Attorney General of the United States.
I assume even with Jefferson behind the idea, leaving an established position and coming to a brand new university, a new idea in Virginia, was a challenge for many people.
It was indeed. And actually, we've got a marvelous correspondence with the first British professor who arrived, who wrote a list of questions about the extent of academic freedom, whether there was any form of tenure, and explained his ambivalence about leaving Britain. He was particularly worried about his family. He asked, would there be sort of polite society in Charlottesville, equivalent to that of Britain? But he added that Britain was a great place for a wealthy person, but not for someone like himself, was therefore enticed by the idea.
Now, one of the issues we must discuss, of course, is slavery. How did slavery impact the creation and the spirit of the university at the very beginnings?
Well, Alan Taylor has done a book that really, first and foremost, discusses the influence of slavery on Jefferson's educational views. It's called Jefferson and Education. It certainly played a significant role. It was part of the explanation of why planters were unwilling to spend money on education, and especially public education. They were largely concerned with fellow members of the elite. Of course, the university was blemished, as were all universities in the South, by the presence of enslaved people working in various roles in the university, building the University, and they were a ubiquitous presence. Indeed, Maury McInnes has estimated that there were probably 200 enslaved people on what elsewhere in America we call the campus at the University of Virginia. They call it the grounds. 200 people, which is twice as many enslaved people as students. The students were prohibited from bringing enslaved people and enslaved servants with them. That was very unusual. They were also prohibited from having guns, but it certainly didn't prevent them on occasion having guns. So we can assume that they may have flouted the other rules as well.
In taking on kind of the challenging issue of Jefferson and slavery, you quote Annette Gordon Reed, who said, quote, "Jefferson's vision of equality was not all-inclusive, but it was transformative," unquote. What does that mean?
Well, Annette Gordon Reed is the leading African-American historian of Jefferson. She teaches both law and history at Harvard, and I think has been a great moderating force in the current culture wars and debate on the highly sensitive racial subject. She did an excellent short book recently on Juneteenth, and she manages always to be very positive about the country and the possibilities. And so she was essentially saying, yes, he was limited, his ideas were limited by the reality of his owning enslaved people, some 600 during the course of his life. But the point was that his ideas were transformative, whether you're talking about religious freedom in America, or at least creating the framework of the idea of government by consent, even though those who consented were just an elite part of the male white population at the time. Nevertheless, it created foundations from which we now benefit. I saw her actually on Morning Joe, someone who published a new book had just been saying, I wrote about all the founders, but I at least liked Jefferson. And Joe Scarborough had begun the segment by saying Jefferson's rhetoric was transformative. And he then turned to Annette, who said, well, you said it in the introduction to this segment. His rhetoric was transformative. What more can you ask of a man?
Good stuff, Andrew. Fascinating. Now let's have a little fun with Jefferson and his idea for a university, okay? My first question, UVA's Cavalier nickname was not adopted until around 1923, about 100 years after its founding. Had Jefferson worried himself about such things, what nickname do you think he would have chosen?
Well, it really amuses me that the nickname for the sports teams and for the student body as a whole is the Cavaliers. I actually managed to begin a talk for what was known as a tailgate event for one of the university games, in which I explained the origin of the term, because it wasn't adopted, as you say, until 1923. But there was a long tradition of Virginians thinking of themselves as Cavaliers. That is, the royalist supporters of the Stuart monarchy, some of whom fled to America, a number of whom settled in Virginia, including the only peer in any part of the British Empire, Lord Fairfax, after whom Fairfax, Virginia, is now named. Jefferson would be horrified, or would have been horrified, by such a nickname, because it represented everything he was against. And I cannot help thinking it was sort of amusingly subversive by the students, who subverted a number of Jefferson's ideas, that they didn't have to go along with their founder in every respect. So he ironically would have preferred to have called it the Republican, the Republicans, because
right.
He wanted this to be the embodiment of the Republican Party and pass on the true ideas of 1776. He was always partisan. It's fortunate that that's not the nickname, because the Republican Party at that period was different, and it would have sounded much too partisan in the modern day. You know, it meant something really very different. But he never seems to have considered the issue.
Maybe they should have, yeah. You know, they should have followed Philadelphia's basketball team. It could have been the UVA 76ers.
That's a great idea.
See, that would have been perfect. Anyway, now every university has a good rival, someone the student body and the alumni love to hate. And of course, Jefferson had some pretty good rivals in his day, like Adams and Hamilton come to mind. But at the time of the founding of the university, at the time, were there other colleges or universities that he didn't like? Or maybe some that he did like and used some of their ideas for UVA?
He disliked most of the universities, and he never really looked at American universities as his guide. He thought the University of Pennsylvania was the best university in the 1790s, and by the time of his death, he thought Harvard the best in the United States. But on the whole, he disliked them all and thought that they were too religious and too much leaning towards anti-Republican Federalist ideas. Nevertheless, he had a major impact both on opponents and on allies. Harvard especially, at least four presidents of Harvard cited the University of Virginia. It was a major influence on the University of Michigan, on the founding of MIT, whose first president was a former UVA faculty member, William Barton Rogers, whose widow said that MIT was created in the halls of the University of Virginia.
Now, on his grave marker, Thomas Jefferson was very clear. He wanted Father of the University of Virginia, as well as a couple other fairly significant accomplishments, but they did not include his time as president. Why do you think he purposefully left off his role as our third POTUS?
Well, the conventional explanation is that he didn't want anything that related to government, and especially central government. You know, the other achievements are more related to ideas and aspirations. The person who I thought explained it best was a British CEO of one of the world's largest advertising companies. And he was visiting me at Monticello, and he looked at the gravestone without knowing really very much about Jefferson at all. And he said, "Oh, that's very clever from a marketing point of view, because if you name any of your positions, even the ambassador to France, you immediately enter controversy because there are people who have bad memories." And that was certainly true of his presidency. There were a lot of people at the time of his death still angry by his embargo against France and Britain. And so this, in many ways, was made for a better legacy, to focus on the aspirations and ideas. Religious freedom, I think, is one of the greatest of them. And you could argue that he saw religious freedom and political freedom as essential for intellectual freedom, that in some ways was the greatest of all.
Now, Jefferson and many other important historic figures have been the target for some tough headlines recently. Why do you think it's still so important to hear these stories and understand the characters behind the statues?
Well, I think if you like him or hate him, you still need to come to terms with the founders of this country, and also to realize that their limitations were also the limitations of the country. Jefferson was not the only slave owner. Racism was essentially typical of the country right up to the Civil War, even abolitionists. And so I well understand why some people may be very critical and may want to dismiss him. But I think that the challenge for us now in teaching and for school teachers is to try to find a balance. The work of historians has introduced a very important critique and correction to what was often a much too over-positive and celebratory version of our history. At the same time, we need to acknowledge that our life and our world is much better for the existence of these people, that they've left some very solid benefits behind them, and that should be what really on what they are also judged by. And I would just add to that Jefferson understood that he and his generation would be dismissed by later generations. He said, "We will one day be looked upon in the same way as our witch-burning ancestors." The point of the university, and he repeated this again and again, was that each generation needs to rethink even the Constitution, that they need to disband with what he called the dead hand of the past, and based on evidence and facts, they should be able to make changes that they see as most beneficial and improving their society.
Andrew, Alan and I really enjoyed your book. Good stuff. Are you working on anything new or any big events coming up this year at Monticello?
I am. I'm actually, in the course of writing this book, I came across a visitor account by a man called Edward Stanley at the age of 24 and 25. And many of the ideas he gained in America, he took with him to Britain. He arrived with a very positive attitude, a view that Britain had something to learn from this experimental republic, and that was very fresh. He was particularly insightful on the state of race in America and made the most amazing statement that the entire country, the white population, were terrified that they'd one day become a mongrel race and elect a black president, after which he added 3 exclamation points.
Yeah, absolutely. Sounds fascinating. Mm-hmm. Looking forward to it. Well, listen, Andrew, thank you so much for taking the time to join us. We hope you had a good time here on American POTUS.
I did indeed. And I should say, in terms of big events at Monticello, July the 4th always a great time to be here. And we're planning a lot of events in the build-up to the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence and, of course, Jefferson's death in 2026. And we celebrate our own anniversary as a foundation, our 100th year in next year.
Wow, you got a lot of stuff coming up. You're going to be a busy man. Andrew, again, thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
And Alan and Scott, thank you very much indeed. It's been a pleasure.
Saying Thomas Jefferson is an enigma is a vast understatement. There are so many sides to this man, some magnificent and revolutionary, others revolting to us today. It's as if the whole story of America's internal civil war over the meaning of our country was embodied in one man. The only way to better understand him and our country is through education. That's the whole purpose of American POTUS, to expand our understanding of the presidency and the men, so far, who have filled that office. Our learning is never done. Jefferson, among his mix of virtues and vices, recognized that a successful republic can only be preserved if we continually educate ourselves. Only then can we effectively analyze and take action on the issues we face in every generation. As we learn more, as we look at new perspectives, it doesn't mean we throw away the past. Indeed, we must learn from it and be true to our founding ideas, but we cannot stop learning and trying new ways of fulfilling the great promise of our nation. One way that we have excelled in that learning is through our amazing universities. Jefferson early on saw their importance, and hence, as Andrew showed us in today's episode, he threw his heart and soul into the founding of the University of Virginia, which, although it's no University of Kentucky, which is my alma mater, it remains today an excellent institution of higher learning. Its founding alone is an amazing legacy for an intriguing, confusing, revolutionary man.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the American POTUS podcast. We'd like to thank author Andrew O'Shaughnessy for joining us on this episode about Thomas Jefferson. More information on all of his terrific books can be found on AmericanPOTUS.org. And we would also like to thank all of you that have made a tax-deductible financial contribution to support this podcast. In addition to this show, your generosity helps us develop new groundbreaking podcast shows and revolutionary outreach programs, offering clarity and perspective to today's political conversations. If you'd like to contribute, it's easy. Simply visit AmericanPOTUS.org. We appreciate your help. American POTUS is produced by American History Studios. Graphic design by Prowler Design, and original music score by Jonathan Clark Music. Finally, it's our presidential last word from Thomas Jefferson, quote, "When describing the University of Virginia, here we are not afraid to follow truth wherever it may lead, nor to tolerate any error, so long as reason is left free to combat it."